Macmillan Audio presents Furiously Happy by Jenny Lawson. Read for you by the author.
This book is dedicated to my daughter, the giggling witness to the strange and wonderful world her family has created out of insanity, both real and hyperbolic. God help us when she is old enough to write her own memoir. Advance praise for Furiously Happy. It was the best of books, it was the worst of hairbrushes. Read it, don't tease your hair with it. Charles Dickens. Jesus gave me this book when he was done with it, saying, "You have got to read this shit, Kevin. It is fucking fantastic." Jesus is terrible with names. Ernest Hemingway. There are few people whom I really love, and still fewer of whom I think well, but only one whose face I want to peel off and wear around my parlor. Lock thy door, Mrs. Lawson. Jane Austen. I can say, without exaggeration, this is the finest coaster I have ever owned. Dorothy Parker. It's life that matters, nothing but life. The process of discovering, the everlasting and perpetual process, not the discovery itself at all. That and this book. This book is nice too. Dostoevsky. Who let you in here? Stephen King. I seem to have lost my coat. William Shakespeare. You don't even know these people in your blurbs. Most of them are dead, and Stephen King is probably going to press charges. We are really going to need to increase your visits. My current shrink. This is where I was going to put a simple Mary Oliver quote, but instead I decided to replace that with an idea that I had for the cover of this book because I'm pretty sure it's never going to be accepted and I don't want it to go to waste. You probably can't see it since this is an audiobook, but maybe it will make it somewhere on it, or I'll send you a PDF, whatever, email me. But basically, it is half of a raccoon face. And the great thing about this cover is that when you're holding the book up to read it, it looks like the bottom of your face has been replaced by an ecstatic raccoon smile. That way you look friendly and also terrifying to anyone passing by, which is nice because then people won't bother you when you're reading. In fact, you can take that page and glue photocopies of it on the covers of all your other books because it's like a subtle do not disturb sign. People may think you're a slow reader after a few years of this, but it's worth it for the uninterrupted peace and the added joy of being half a raccoon. If you disagree, then this is probably the wrong book for you. You've been warned. A series of unfortunate disclaimers. No, I insist you stop right now. Still here? Awesome. Now you're not allowed to blame me for anything in this book because I told you to stop. And you just kept going. You're like Bluebeard's wife when she found all those heads in the closet, spoiler alert. But personally, I think that's a good thing. Ignoring the severed human heads in the closet doesn't make for a good relationship. It makes for an unsanitary closet and possible accessory charges. You have to confront those decapitated heads because you can't grow without acknowledging that we are all made up from the weirdness that we try to hide from the rest of the world. Everyone has human heads in their closet. Sometimes the heads are secrets, or unsaid confessions, or quiet fears. This book is one of those severed heads. You are holding my severed head in your hands. This is a bad analogy, but in my defense, I did tell you to stop. I don't want to blame the victim, but at this point, we're in this together. Everything in this book is mostly true, but some details have been changed to protect the guilty. And I know it's usually about protecting the innocent, but why would they need protection? They're innocent. And also, they're not nearly as fun to write about as the guilty, who always have more fascinating stories and who make you feel better about yourself by comparison. This is a funny book about living with mental illness. It sounds like a terrible combination, but personally, I'm mentally ill, and some of the most hysterical people I know are as well. So if you don't like the book, maybe you're just not crazy enough to enjoy it. Either way, you win. A note from the author. Dear reader, right now, you're holding this book in your hands and wondering if it's worth listening to this. It's probably not, but there's a $25 bill hidden in the binding, so you should just buy it quickly before the clerk notices. You are welcome. A small footnote here. My editor insists that I clarify that there isn't actually a $25 bill hidden in this book, which is sort of ridiculous to have to explain. First of all, because this is an audiobook, so it's not a real book. And secondly, because there's no such thing as a $25 bill. If you bought this book thinking that you were going to find a $25 bill inside, then I think you really just paid for a worthwhile lesson. And that lesson is, don't sell your cow for magic beans. There was another book that explained this same concept many years ago, but I think my cribbed example is much more exciting. It's like the 50 Shades of Grey version of Jack and the Beanstalk, but with fewer anal beads or beanstalks. Furiously Happy is the name of this book. It's also a little something that saved my life. My grandmother used to say, into everyone's life, a little rain must fall. Rain, assholes, and assorted bullshit. I'm paraphrasing, but she was right. We all get our share of tragedy or insanity or drama, but it's what we do with that horror that makes all the difference. I learned this firsthand a few years ago when I fell into a severe bout of depression, so terrific that I couldn't see a way out of it. The depression wasn't anything new. I've struggled with many forms of mental illness since I was a kid, but clinical depression is a semi-regular visitor, and anxiety disorder is my long-term abusive boyfriend. Sometimes the depression is mild enough that I mistake it for the flu or mono, but this instance was one of those extreme cases, one where I didn't necessarily want my life to end, I just wanted it to stop being such a bastard. I reminded myself that depression lies, because it does. I told myself that things would get better. I did all of the normal things that sometimes help, but I still felt hopeless, and suddenly I found myself really angry. Angry that life can throw such curveballs at you. Angry at the seeming unfairness of how tragedy is handed out. Angry because I had no other emotions left to give. So I took to my blog and I wrote a post that would change the way that I would look at life from then on. October 2010. All things considered, the last 6 months have been a goddamn Victorian tragedy. Today, my husband Victor handed me a letter informing me that another friend had unexpectedly died. You might think this would push me over the edge into an irreversible downward spiral of Xanax and Regina Spektor songs, but no, it's not. I am fucking done with sadness, and I don't know what's up the ass of the universe lately, but I have had it. I'm going to be furiously happy out of sheer spite. Can you hear that? That's me smiling, y'all. I'm smiling so loud you can fucking hear it. I'm going to destroy the goddamn universe with my irrational joy, and I will spew forth pictures of clumsy kittens and baby puppies adopted by raccoons and motherfucking newborn llamas dipped in glitter and the blood of sexy vampires, and it's gonna be awesome. In fact, I'm starting a whole movement right now, the Furiously Happy Movement. And it's going to be awesome because, first of all, we're all going to be vehemently happy. And secondly, because it will freak the shit out of everyone that hates you because those assholes don't want to see you even vaguely amused, much less furiously happy. And it will make the world turn a little sideways and will probably scare the shit out of them, which will make you even more happy, legitimately. And then the world tips in our favor. Us won, assholes 8 million. That score doesn't look as satisfying as it should because they have a bit of a head start. Except, you know what? Fuck that. We're starting from scratch. Us one, asshole zero. Within a few hours, hashtag Furiously Happy was trending worldwide on Twitter as people loudly fought to take back their lives from the monster of depression. And that was just the beginning. Over the next few years, I pushed myself to say yes to anything ridiculous. I jumped into fountains that were not meant to be jumped into. I took impromptu road trips to hunt down UFOs. I chased tornadoes. I wore a wolf who died of kidney failure to the local Twilight premiere while shouting Team Jacob at angry vampire fans. I rented sloths by the hour. My new mantra was decorum is highly overrated and probably causes cancer. In short, I went a little insane in slow but certain spurts, and it was the best possible thing that could have happened to me. This didn't mean that I wasn't still depressed or anxious or mentally ill. I still spent my share of weeks in bed when I simply couldn't get up. I still hid under my office desk whenever the anxiety got too heavy to battle standing up. The difference was that I had a storeroom in the back of my mind filled with moments of tightrope walking snorkeling in long-forgotten caves and running barefoot through cemeteries with a red ball gown trailing behind me, I could remind myself that as soon as I had the strength to get up out of bed, I would again turn my hand to being furiously happy, not just to save my life, but to make my life. There's something about depression that allows you, or sometimes forces you, to explore depths of emotion that most, quote, normal people could never conceive of. Imagine having a disease so overwhelming that your mind causes you to want to murder yourself. Imagine having a malignant disorder that no one understands. Imagine having a dangerous affliction that even you can't control or suppress. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine the estate of John Lennon not suing me for using that last line. Then imagine that same, often fatal disease being one of the most misunderstood disorders, one that so few want to talk about and one that so many of us can never completely escape from. I've often thought that people with severe depression have developed such a well for experiencing extreme emotion that they might be able to experience extreme joy in a way that, quote, normal people might never understand. And that's what Furiously Happy is all about. It's about taking those moments when things are fine and making them amazing, because those moments are what make us who we are, and they're the same moments we take into battle with us when our brains declare war on our very existence. It's the difference between surviving life and living life. It's the difference between taking a shower and teaching your monkey butler how to shampoo your hair. It's the difference between being sane and being furiously happy. Now, some people might think that this furiously happy movement is just an excuse to be stupid and irresponsible and invite a herd of kangaroos over to your house without telling your husband first because you suspect he would say no since he's never particularly liked kangaroos. And that would be ridiculous because no one would invite a herd of kangaroos into their house. Two is the limit. I speak from personal experience. My husband, Victor, says that none is the new limit. I say he should have been clearer about that before I rented all of those kangaroos. The Furiously Happy movement sparked the silver ribbon concept, an idea that grew from a blog post and resonated with thousands of people in spite of the fact that none of us actually ever made any silver ribbons because we were all too depressed to do crafts. Here's the original post. When cancer sufferers fight, recover, and go into remission, we laud their bravery. We wear ribbons to celebrate their fight. We call them survivors because they are. When depression sufferers fight, recover, and go into remission, we seldom even know, simply because so many suffer in the dark, ashamed to admit something they see as a personal weakness, afraid that people will worry, and more afraid that they won't. We find ourselves unable to do anything but cling to the couch and force ourselves to breathe. When you come out of the grips of a depression, there's an incredible relief, but not when you feel like you're allowed to celebrate. Instead, the feeling of victory is replaced with anxiety that it will happen again, and with shame and vulnerability when you see how your illness has affected your family, your work, everything left untouched while you struggle to survive. We come back to life thinner, paler, weaker, but as survivors. Survivors who don't get pats on the back from coworkers who congratulate them on making it. Survivors who wake to more work than before because their friends and family are exhausted from helping them fight a battle they may not even understand. I hope to one day see a sea of people all wearing silver ribbons as a sign that they understand the secret battle and as a celebration of the victories made each day as we individually pull ourselves out of our foxholes to see our scars heal and to remember what the sun looks like. I hope one day to be better, and I'm pretty sure I will be. I hope one day I live in a world where the personal fight for mental stability is viewed with pride and public cheers instead of shame. And I hope it for you too. But until then, it starts slowly. I haven't hurt myself in 3 days. I sing strange battle songs to myself in the darkness to scare away the demons. I'm a fighter when I need to be, and for that I am proud. I celebrate every one of you listening to this. I celebrate the fact that you fought your battle and continue to win. I celebrate the fact that you may not understand the battle, but you pick up the baton dropped by someone that you love until they can carry it again. I survived, and I remind myself that each time we go through this, we get a little stronger. We learn new tricks on the battlefield. We learn them in terrible ways, but we use them. We don't struggle in vain. We win. We are alive. And we are. I want this book to help people fighting with mental illness, and also those who have friends and family who are affected by it. I want to show people that there can be advantages to being a bit touched, as my grandmother put it. I want my daughter to understand what's wrong with me and what's right with me. I want to give hope. I want to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, but without selling any Coca-Cola products. This book is less a sequel to my last one and more a collection of bizarre essays and conversations and confused thoughts stuck together by spilled boxed wine and the frustrated tears of baffled editors who have no choice but to accept my belief that it's perfectly acceptable to make up something if you need a word for something that doesn't already exist, and that punctuation is really more of a suggestion than a law. It's called Concoctulary, y'all. I hope that you will find it to be the perfect follow-up to my last book. Strange, funny, honest, and more than a little bit peculiar, but in the best possible way, like all of us. As a footnote, concoctulary is a word that I just made up for words that you have to invent because they don't exist yet. It's a portmanteau of concocted and vocabulary. I was going to call it imaginary as a portmanteau of imagined and dictionary, but it turns out that the word imaginary was already concoctularied, which is actually fine because concoctulary sort of sounds unintentionally dirty and is also great fun to say. Try it for yourself. Concoctulary. It sings. One more footnote. My mental illness is not your mental illness. Even if we have the exact same diagnosis, we will likely experience it in profoundly different ways. This book is my unique perspective on my personal path so far. It is not a textbook. If it were, it would probably cost a lot more money and have significantly less profanity or stories about strangers sending you unexpected vaginas in the mail. As it is with all stories, fast cars, wild bears, mental illness, and even life, only one truth remains. Your mileage may vary. Chapter 1. Furiously Happy, Dangerously Sad. You're not crazy. Stop calling yourself crazy, my mom says for the 11 billionth time. You're just sensitive and a little odd. Yeah, and fucked up enough to require an assload of meds, I add. That's not crazy, my mom says as she turns back to scrubbing the dishes. You're not crazy and you need to stop saying that you are. It makes you sound like a lunatic. I laugh because this is a familiar argument. This is the same one we've had a million times before and the same one we'll have a million times again. So I let it lie. And besides, she's technically right. I'm not technically crazy. But crazy is a much simpler way of labeling what I really am. According to the many shrinks that I've seen in the last two decades, I am a high-functioning depressive with severe anxiety disorder, moderate clinical depression, and mild self-harm issues that stem from an impulse control disorder. I have avoidant personality disorder, which is like social anxiety disorder on speed, and occasional depersonalization disorder, which makes me feel utterly detached from reality, but in less of a this LSD is awesome kind of way, and more of a I wonder what my face is doing right now, and it sure would be nice to feel emotions again sort of thing. I have rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune issues, and sprinkled in like paprika over a mentally unbalanced deviled egg are things like mild OCD and trichotillomania, the urge to pull one's hair out, which is always nice to end on because whenever people hear the word mania, they automatically back off and give you more room on crowded airplanes. Probably because you're not supposed to talk about having manias when you're on a crowded airplane. This is one of the reasons why my husband Victor hates to fly with me. The other reason is that I often fly with taxidermied creatures as anxiety service animals. Basically, we don't travel a lot together because he doesn't understand awesomeness. You're not a maniac, my mom says in an aggravated voice. You just like to pull your hair. You even did it when you were little. It's soothing to you, like petting a kitten. I like to pull my hair out, I clarify. It's sort of different. That's why they call it a mania and not kitten petting disorder, which would honestly suck to have because then you'd end up with a bunch of semi-bald kittens who would hate you. Oh my God, I hope I never get overly enthusiastic kitten fur pulling disorder. My mother sighs deeply, but this is exactly why I love having these conversations with her, because she gives me perspective. It's also why she hates having these conversations with me, because I give her details. You are perfectly normal, my mom says, shaking her head as if even her body won't let her get away with this sort of lie. I laugh as I tug involuntarily at my hair. I have never been normal, and I think we both know that. My mom pauses for a moment, trying to think up another line of defense, but it's pretty hopeless. I have always been naturally anxious to a ridiculous degree. My earliest school memory is of a field trip to a hospital when a doctor pulled out some blood samples and I immediately passed out right into a wall of thankfully empty bedpans. According to the other kids present, the teacher said, "Ignore her, she just wants attention." Then my head started bleeding and the doctor cracked open an ammonia capsule under my nose, which is a lot like being punched in the face by an invisible fist of stink. Honestly, I don't even know why I passed out. My baseline of anxiety remained the same, but my subconscious was apparently so terrified that it decided the safest place for me to be was fast asleep on the floor surrounded by bedpans. Which sort of shows why my body is an idiot, because forced narcolepsy is pretty much the worst defense ever. It's like the human version of playing possum, which is only helpful if bears are trying to eat you, because apparently, if you lie down in front of bears, they're all, "What a badass, I attack her and she takes a cat nap. I probably shouldn't fuck with her." This would be the start of a long and ridiculous period of my life, which shrinks label white coat syndrome. My family refers to it as what the hell is wrong with Jenny syndrome. I think my family was more accurate in their assessment because passing out when you see doctor's coats is just damn ridiculous and more than slightly embarrassing, especially later when you have to say, "Sorry that I passed out on you. Apparently, I'm afraid of coats." To make things even worse, when I pass out, I tend to flail about on the floor, and apparently I moan gutturally. Like a Frankenstein, according to my mom, who has witnessed this on several occasions. Other people might battle a subconscious fear of adversity or failure or being stoned to death, but my hidden phobia makes me faint at the sight of outerwear. I have passed out once at the optometrist's, twice at the dentist's office, and two horrifying times at the gynecologist's. The nice thing, though, about passing out at the gynecologist is that if you're already up in the stirrups, you don't have far to fall, unless, of course, you're like me and you flail about wildly while you're moaning and unconscious. It's pretty much the worst way to pass out with someone in your vagina. It's like having a really unattractive orgasm you're not even awake for. I always remind my gynecologist that I might rather loudly pass out during a pap smear, and then she usually grimly informs me that she didn't need me to remind her of that at all. Probably, my sister says, because most people don't make as much of a theatrical show about fainting. The really bad part about passing out at the gynecologist is that you occasionally regain consciousness with an unexpected speculum inside your vagina, which is essentially the third worst way to wake up. The second worst way to wake up is at the gynecologist without a speculum inside of you, because the gynecologist took it out when you passed out and now you have to start all over again, which is why I always tell my gynecologist that if I pass out when they're in my vagina, they should just take that opportunity to get everything out of the way while I'm out. The first worst way to wake up is to find bears eating you because your body thought that its safest defense was to fall asleep in front of bears. That playing possum bullshit almost never works. Not that I know, because I would never pass out in front of bears, because that would be ridiculous. In fact, I've been known to actually run at bears to get a good picture of them. Instead, I pass out in front of coats, which, according to my brain, are the things you really need to be concerned about. One time, I loudly lost consciousness at my veterinarian's office when he called my name. Apparently, my subconscious freaked out when I saw blood on the vet's coat, and then I abruptly passed out right on my cat. Not a euphemism. I woke up, shirtless, in the lobby with a bunch of strangers and dogs looking down at me. Evidently, when I started moaning, the vet called an ambulance, and when the EMTs arrived, they claimed they couldn't find my heartbeat, so they ripped open my shirt. Personally, I think they just wanted a cheap thrill. I think the dogs looking down on me agreed, as they seemed slightly embarrassed for me after watching the whole spectacle unfold. But you can't really blame the dogs, because first of all, who can look away from a train wreck like that? And secondly, dogs have no concept of modesty. Waking up shirtless with a bunch of concerned dogs staring at your bra because you're afraid of coats is about the seventh worst way to wake up, I mutter aloud to my mother. My mom replies noncommittally, raising a single eyebrow. Well, okay, Maybe you're not normal normal, she says grudgingly. But who wants to be normal? You're fine. You're perfectly fine. You're better than normal even, because you're so aware of what's wrong with you that you can recognize it and sort of fix it. I nod. She has a point, although the rest of the world might disagree with our definition of fixing it. When I was little, I fixed it by hiding from the world in my empty toy box whenever my undiagnosed anxiety got too unbearable. In high school, I fixed it by isolating myself from other people. In college, I fixed it with eating disorders, controlling what I ate to compensate for the lack of control that I felt with my emotions. And now, as an adult, I control it with medication and with shrink visits and with behavioral therapy. I control it by being painfully honest about just how crazy I am. I control it by allowing myself to hide in bathrooms and under tables during important events. And sometimes I control it by letting it control me, because I have no other choice. Sometimes I'm unable to get out of bed for a week at a time. Anxiety attacks are still an uncomfortable and terrifying part of my life. But after my furiously happy epiphany, I've learned the importance of pushing through, knowing that one day soon, I'll be happy again. This is why I sneak into other people's bathrooms and haunted hotels and once accepted a job as a political czar who reports directly to the stray cat that sleeps in City Hall. I have staged live zombie apocalypse drills in crowded ballrooms, and I've landed on aircraft carriers at sea. I once crowdfunded enough money to buy a taxidermied Pegasus. I am furiously happy. It's not a cure for mental illness. It's a weapon designed to counter it. It's a way to take back some of the joy that's robbed from you when you're crazy. Ah, you're not crazy, my mom says again, waving a wet plate at me. Stop saying you're crazy. People will think you're a lunatic. And it's true. They will. I Google the word lunatic on my phone and read her one of the definitions. Lunatic. Noun. Wildly or giddily foolish. My mom pauses, stares at me, and finally sighs, recognizing way too much of me in that definition. She says, shrugging thoughtfully as she turns back to the sink. So, maybe crazy isn't so bad after all. I agree. Sometimes crazy is just right. Chapter 2. I found a kindred soul, and he has a very healthy coat. A few weeks ago, I was at the pharmacy picking up my meds, and I was staring into the drive-thru window and thinking about how awesome it is that we live in a world where you can pick up drugs in a drive-thru, and that's when I noticed something strange next to the pharmacist register. If you had the book, you could actually see a picture of this, because it is unfucking believable. Basically, it's the window of the pharmacy, and sitting next to the computer is an open box of Milk-Bone dog biscuits. And I thought, well, that's odd, but maybe someone returned them because they were stale or something. And then I thought it was even odder that someone could realize that dog biscuits had gone stale, because dogs aren't usually very good at not eating cookies, even if they're fairly shitty. I mean, dogs eat used diapers if you let them, so I'm pretty sure none of them are saying no to cookies. But then the pharmacist came back, and while he was ringing me up, he reached over and picked up a handful of broken dog biscuits and ate them. And then I thought, wait, am I high right now? Is he high? Am I being tested? Should I say something? But I didn't, because I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to accuse the man giving you drugs of eating dog food. And then I signed for the drugs and drove away, and I thought to myself, is it possible he accidentally ate the dog biscuits? Or maybe someone is always stealing his food at work, so he decided to put his tasty human cookies, made for humans, not from humans, in a Milk-Bone box to keep them safe? Or maybe he just likes to entertain himself by seeing if people will tell him that he's eating dog food. Those would probably be good people. I'm not one of those people. But then I spent all day thinking, why the dog biscuits? And so I went back today to ask, but the dog biscuits were gone and the dog biscuit eating guy was also gone. And I thought, can I ask this pharmacist if the other pharmacist who eats dog food is around, because I need to know the story? And the answer is no, I can't. But I really want to know, because I suspect that I would be great friends with this guy, because anyone who would hide crackers in a dog food box seems like someone I'd just like to hang out with. Although someone who just eats dog food for fun seems slightly more questionable. Except now I'm wondering if maybe Milk-Bones are really delicious and he's just a genius who's discovered really cheap cookies. Cookies you don't even have to call your judgmental vet about when your dog gets into the pantry and eats all of them. You still have to call the vet, though, when your cat has eaten a toy consisting of a tinkle bell and a feather and a poof ball all tied together with twine. That actually happened once, and it was really the worst because the vet told me that I'd have to ply the cat with laxatives to make sure that the toy would pass easily through, and then I'd have to inspect the poop to make sure that the toy had passed because otherwise I'd have to do open cat surgery. And then it finally did start to pass, but just the first part with the tinkle bell, and the cat was freaked out because he was running away from the tinkle bell hanging out of his butthole. And when I called the vet, he said to definitely not pull on the twine because it could pull out his intestines, which would be the grossest pinata ever. And so I just ran after the cat with some scissors to cut off the tinkle bell, which impressively was still tinkling after seeing things that no tinkle bell should ever see. Probably the cat was running away because of the tinkle bell and because I was chasing it with scissors, screaming, "Let me help you!" If I was good friends with that dog food eating pharmacist, I would have called him to tell him all about the tinkle bell issue because he probably would have appreciated it. But I never found him again because I was worried that if I ever asked to see the dog food eating pharmacist, the other pharmacists would stop giving me drugs. This feels a bit discriminatory, but I can't explain exactly why. Chapter 3. My phone is more fun to hang out with than me. When I wake up in the morning, I often find messages left to me on my phone. Then I read the messages and I suspect that I'm being stalked by a madwoman. And I am. That madwoman is me. The calls are coming from inside the house. Some of these notes are written while I'm waiting for my sleeping pills to kick in, but most are written at 2 a.m. when I'm convinced that I've come up with something brilliant and then I'll forget it if I don't jot it down immediately. And then in the morning, I congratulate myself because I have forgotten what it was. And I'm a little disappointed that the messages are less world-shattering and more just plain confusing. These missives from my brain are baffling, but I never delete them because it's nice to have a pen pal that I don't have to write back to, and also because I can look at the strange notes and think, finally, someone gets me. These are a few of those notes from my phone. The phrase, "I'm not going to say I told you so," is pretty much the same thing as saying "I told you so," except worse because you're saying "I told you so" and congratulating yourself for your restraint in not saying what you totally just said. Are asparaguses just artichokes that haven't grown properly, like they started smoking and got really skinny like supermodels? I bet marmalade was invented by the laziest person in the world. Eating a peach is like eating a newborn baby's head. And then it's all soft and fuzzy. Not that peaches taste like babies. I don't eat babies. Or peaches, actually, because they remind me of eating babies. Vicious circle, really. Today at lunch, the waiter told me that the soup of the day was beef and yumen. And I was like, what the shit? He said that he had had some and that it was good, but really heavy on the yumen. And Victor was like, that sounds great. I'll have a bowl of that. And I felt like I had fallen into the Twilight Zone movie. But it turns out that the waiter was just saying beef and cumin, which honestly sounds almost as gross. Is it illegal to use shower curtains as regular curtains and vice versa? If not, what if you went shopping for a shower curtain but then bought a valance? That seems like it should be a misdemeanor at the least. The phrase "rest in peace" seems incredibly self-serving. It basically means stay in your grave, don't haunt me. Like the opposite would be fitfully toss or let's go jogging. I don't get the anti-slut shaming movement. They're like, don't shame the sluts. And I'm like, you're the one calling them sluts. It's like having to lay off the fatties campaign. If the plural of octopus is octopi, then why isn't the plural of rabbit rabbi? Is it just because octopuses is too much fun to say? One of Victor's friends had a pet called Terry the Truth Cat. When she was little and her father thought she was lying, he would pick the cat up and say, "You kids tell me the truth or Terry gets it." I guess it was supposed to help with honesty, but it seemed pretty fucked up. Plus, I don't think I could threaten a cat. Maybe we could get Terry the Truth Turtle and threaten him with like a fake gun. We'd be trying to get our daughter Haley to tell the truth, and he'd just hide his head in his shell like, I'm not part of this, I'm not with you guys. But I don't like guns, so maybe we could hold it over a pot of boiling water? But what if we accidentally steamed it? Oh my God, that would suck. Fuck it. I'd just rather let Haley learn to lie really well. "We Wish You a Merry Christmas" is the most demanding song ever. It starts off all nice, and then a second later, you have an angry mob at your door scream singing, "Now bring us some figgy pudding and bring it right here! We won't go until we get some, so bring it right here!" And also, they're rhyming here with here. That's just sloppy. I'm not rewarding unrequested lazy singers with their aggressive pudding demands. There should be a remix of that song that homeowners can sing that's all, "I didn't even ask for your shitty song, you filthy beggars. I've called the cops." Who is this even working on? Has anyone you've tried this on actually given you pudding? Fig-flavored pudding? Is this even a thing? It doesn't rhyme, but it's not like they're trying either. And then the carolers would be like, "So bring us some gin and tonic and let's have a beer." And then I'd be like, "Well, I guess that's more reasonable. Fine, you can come in for one drink." Technically, that would be a good way to get free booze, like trick or treat, but for singy alcoholics. Oh my God, I finally understand caroling. I almost never use BC and AD to describe time periods. I use BKCWC before Kirk Cameron went crazy. That's how I judge time. Why is it incapable and unable instead of incapable and inable? You can have an inability, but you can't be unable. I am incapable of understanding how these decisions were made. If I were a dominatrix, I would force my submissive to do my washing up and clean the fridge and brush the cats. And whenever he tried to say the safety word, banana, to make me stop because it wasn't what he wanted, I would chuckle softly and say, "No, Gary, that is definitely not the safety word." And I would tighten the leash and hand him a mop, and I'd say, "So your wife won't do this for you? That's so sad. Now finish the floors and go pick up my dry cleaning." And it would be like 10 years later, and I'd still have someone to pick me up at the airport and do all the shit I didn't want to do. And then on his deathbed, I'd say, "Hey, Gary, I was just kidding. The secret word really was banana." And then we'd laugh and laugh. When Victor and I are fighting, I like to pull out my phone and take a selfie of us together because that way, when he tells me to calm down, I can prove that I'm less mad than he is because how can you think I've lost my temper? Look at me in this picture. I look adorable. You look like the one with the temper problem. It's also nice because when I'm taking the picture, he either has to smile or he has to choose to look shitty. Either way, I win. Plus, I have a terrible picture of him that I can threaten to tweet out if he doesn't agree that I'm probably right about everything. I wonder if when birds are new, they ever try to land on clouds. And if so, is it like when you think you've gone down that last stair where there's still another one and you step off and make that weird oof noise and everyone looks at you? That would suck. But at least birds are hidden when they fuck up and fall through clouds. I find it very confusing that people refer to good days as the salad days. No one wants salad. Is it because rich people always serve salad even though it usually just gets thrown away? Does it mean that if you're rich enough to serve food just to be thrown away, then you've made it? Because that kind of makes sense. Bruce Springsteen said, "You can't start a fire without a spark, but you can start it with a magnifying glass." I mean, it ruins the rhyme scheme, but at the cost of science and arson. And maybe it's still a spark, even if it starts with a magnifying glass. Maybe the first flame is always a spark. But that's like saying you can't start a fire without a fire. That's just sloppy songwriting. Bruce Springsteen is obviously not the boss of scientific accuracy. Do they call a crib a creche because it sounds like crotch and babies come from crotches? If so, that seems very lazy, but it's nice that they put an accent on it because it adds a desperately needed touch of elegance. Kids don't use paper book covers anymore. Why is that? They're missing out on the best part of school, which is doodling genitals and curse words and hiding them in flowery vines. There used to be advertisements on ours, mostly for the cotton gin and the funeral home, which was weird because we were children and we had no money or inclination for either. I never understood paying for a burial when you could just let pigs eat your body. I mean, we were surrounded by pig farms, and those pigs needed to eat, so two birds, one stone. We'd just turn our covers backward after we had drawn an inappropriately erect man in a coffin and use the fresh blank covers to practice future tattoo designs. We also had leather notebooks at our school, which I'm told is something that not everyone had. They were these leather zippered notebooks with your name hand-tooled on them by the local saddle maker. You used it to carry your homework, and everyone had one, but they were really expensive. I finally got one as a combination birthday Christmas present when I was in eighth grade, and I was so excited. So basically, I got school supplies as a present, and I was fucking ecstatic. Those were simpler times. The salad days.
Probably. My point is, kids get super excited about the stupidest things, and then the stupidest things become incredibly popular. And that's why I now try to avoid popular things like school supplies, and instead, I lean toward unpopular things like being eaten by pigs. Conceptually, I mean. I've been around a lot of pigs, and none of them have ever tried to eat me. The pig farmer next door told me that that's because pigs are picky and they won't eat people who are still alive. This seems odd, because I think wanting to eat a corpse is sort of the opposite of being a picky eater, but I'll defer to the experts on this one. Whenever Haley tells me that the kids at school were mean to her, I want to go find those kids and tell them that I'm them from the future and that they failed miserably. And then I'd be like, and look how fat you got. Yesterday, I was at the gas station, and I saw a woman whose kid is in Haley's Girl Scout troop, but I was in my pajamas, so I was hiding in the back until she left. There was a collection of cards, and I perused them to try to look normal, but the one that I picked up was a can of beans with googly eyes, and I thought that was weird, but it turns out that it's one of those cards that sings and moves when you open it. So I'm standing there holding a googly-eyed can of beans as it shakes and loudly farts the birthday song to me in a gas station. It was like I was competing for an award for being the most conspicuously uncool person ever. I waved weakly at the woman and said, that wasn't me, but she wasn't buying it. I should have slapped the card to the ground and yelled witchcraft, but you always think about these things too late. My blood test came back as low in magnesium and selenium, but instead of prescribing a vitamin, my doctor prescribed 2 Brazil nuts a day. I always thought that in the future, food was supposed to be in pill form, but now I'm taking pills in food form. We're going backward here. Also, it sort of sucks that the one nut I'm prescribed is the worst nut, the one everyone throws away. I need to start a fundraiser where everyone in the world just sends me the 2 nuts that are always left in the bottom of the can. I told Victor that I'd gotten my test results and that they've prescribed me nuts. Victor says I'm confusing prescribed with diagnosed. Benedict Cumberbatch is like Alan Rickman, Benjamin Buttoning. I don't understand why people keep pushing that don't be some random person, be unique message. You're already incredibly unique. Everyone is incredibly unique. That's why the police use fingerprints to identify people. So you're incredibly unique, but in the exact same way that everyone else is, which admittedly doesn't really sing and is never going to make it on a motivational t-shirt. So none of us are unique in being unique because being unique is pretty much the least unique thing that you can be because it comes naturally to everyone. So perhaps instead of be unique, we should be saying be as visibly fucked up as you want to be because being unique is already taken by everyone, ironically enough. Or maybe we could just change the message to don't just be some random person, be the most random person. The amount of money I would pay for people to stop fucking up grammar is only slightly lower than the amount that I would give to ensure that I never have grammatical errors in the statements that I make calling others out on their grammatical errors. If you put a bunch of chameleons on top of a bunch of chameleons on top of a bowl of Skittles, what would happen? Is that science? Because if so, I finally get why people want to do science. I should start the Museum of Missing Stuff. It'd be filled with empty glass cases of stuff that's not there. Also a giant room of stray socks and keys, and my sense of rationalism, and Victor's sense of whimsy, and his patience. That place would be crammed. We might have to expand. People who think it's so hard to find a needle in a haystack are probably not quilters. Needles find you. Just walk on the haystack for a second. You'll find the needle. They're worse than floor Legos. And if that doesn't work, just burn some fucking hay. They should change like finding a needle in a haystack to like finding a pen that works in a drawer filled with pens that don't work. People wonder how Victor and I have stayed married for so long, even though he's Republican and I'm super liberal. I think it all comes down to communication and compromise. Like last week when Victor said, if you renew your PETA membership, I will run over a squirrel. He's bluffing though, unless it was someone else's car. I'm allergic to latex, and it makes me break out in a rash, so most condoms are out for me because the last thing any one of us wants is a vagina rash. The alternative, though, are the ones made of sheepskin, but it always creeps me out because does that mean that Victor and I are having sex with a sheep? A dead sheep, actually? So it's bestiality and necrophilia? and a three-way, I think. I actually mentioned that to Victor, and he immediately booked a vasectomy, which is sweet because it's nice that he cares about me. He claimed it was less his caring and more, quote, I'd rather have my nuts cut off than have to listen to you talking about having three ways with dead sheep. But now I have all these leftover condoms. They make great water balloons, though, and I bet they'd be really good for championship bubblegum blowing competitions. Really chewy sheep bubblegum. That might be cheating. I don't know the rules about bubblegum contests. My grandmother used to say, those are not the kind of underwear you want to get hit by a bus in, but I don't think the underwear has been invented that would make me want to get hit by a bus. Plus, when you're hit by a bus, I think your underwear is probably the last thing on your mind. In fact, when you die, your bowels release and you shit yourself. So even if you were wearing clean underwear, they would not be clean by the time your grandmother got there. That's why I think that they should make underwear with defensive sayings on them, like, I swear these were totally clean this morning. It's the equivalent of those old-fashioned day of the week underwear without having to remember what day it is. I can barely manage to get dressed in the morning, much less have to pass a pop quiz given by my underwear on what day it is. And besides, why am I taking advice on underwear from my grandmother when granny panties are the most universally reviled underthings in existence? When we were kids, our great aunt Ollie used to give my sister and me a roll of dimes and a pack of granny panties every Christmas. They were so enormous that we would pull them up to our necks and pretend that they were strapless leotards while we mimicked the dancers on Fame. Just in the privacy of our own house, though. That would be mortifying in public. And actually, if someone saw me wearing granny panties that went up to my armpits while trying to do the robot, I probably would throw myself in front of a bus. Full circle. The victim was wearing a strapless leotard when she shit herself. A roll of dimes was found on the body. Her grandmother has been contacted to inform her of how badly she failed.